I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello everybody, good to be back with you and welcome to this, the first in a new series of podcasts for the motorsport magazine Hall of Fame. Before we get into the detail of the next Hall of Fame, and there'll be plenty of that coming from our editor Damien in just a few minutes, we have to look back on a really great British Grand Prix. I think we're all still very excited about it. Are we, Mark Hughes? I mean, you've seen a few.
Yeah, for me, that was the best Grand Prix of this season, certainly. One of the best British Grand Prix, I think. I think it was going to be good even before the rain came and made it even more interesting. One of the things that made it was those demon starts the two Williams made, which put the faster cars out of position, the faster cars behind the slower car. Sure. And it brings us back to why do we line the cars up in performance order and then expect them to overtake each other? Because it's not what happens. I think it was interesting in that respect.
I refer the Right Honourable Gentleman to Suzuka 2005, which remains one of the finest races I've attended. I don't know how many I've done, I've lost count, but exactly the same principle.
Back to Silverstone. Don't say it too loudly, because you'll get Bernie on about reverse grids again,
back to the weekend at Silverstone, the home of British motor racing, the British Grand Prix. One of the things for me, Nigel, was the crowd. I mean, it's so fantastic after all this negativity about Formula One and a lot of sort of rather depressing talk about it to see all those people. It's just great atmosphere, wasn't it?
Well, I mean, the new regime brought prices down. I mean, not to a sort of bargain level, but prices did come down a bit this year, and they're intending, if they can, to do it next year. And it never really surprises me because, Patrick Tombay always used to say, what is it about you Brits? You know, at a time when there were tiny crowds going to Manicor and that sort of thing, and he said, then you go to Silverstone and look at it, He said, you're just not like the fans anywhere else on earth. And I think there's something in that. We don't even get big crowds at Monza anymore. We haven't had for years.
Well, we love our motor racing, don't we, Damien?
We sure do, yes. I was going to ask Mark what he thought might have happened if the rain hadn't come, because Lewis was getting caught hand over fist by Nico, and it was he was looking a bit vulnerable there. So if he'd been forced to come in anyway, wouldn't he?
They were waiting for, they knew the rain was coming, and Nico had kept some tyre heat because he hadn't been able to push as hard on the outlaps earlier on. So that when the rain came, it was round Luffield and that sort of place, the tyres lost the temperature, and if the less tread you've got on them, the more the temperature falls. And that's what had happened to Lewis, because he'd done that dynamite outlap to get himself ahead of Massa. And then extended his lead, and that's what had stopped the tyres from being able to retain temperature when the rain came. So the fact that Rosberg was catching Hamilton was to do with the rain falling at Luffield. So I think with no rain whatsoever, it would have been a straightforward Lewis win and Nico would have had to do a two-stop, which is what Mercedes were intended to do, to get him ahead of the Williams, because he'd not been able to get past them at the undercut at the pit stops.
I'd like to ask Mark Hughes a question as well. You mentioned the start just now, which was in itself an exciting moment. Will we see a lot more of that when the drivers start the cars, as opposed to the trick technology that we have at the moment?
That's the hope. But talking to a few engineers at the weekend, they were all fairly nonplussed about the idea, and shrugging their shoulders and said, well, we'll find somewhere else. We'll find another way of doing it. It won't make a lot of difference. So let's see. Yeah.
Okay. Simon, your British Grand Prix.
Yeah, I loved every... I mean, I did cheat slightly because I ducked out and went to Alton Park on the Saturday, but I was there Thursday, Friday, Sunday, and enjoyed every second. I thought it was great. I mean, although I no longer attend every race, I do keep up with them as much as I can remotely, and it's the best, certainly the best race I've seen this year. And it was nice to see Williams running at the front. I'd love to know... I mean, had Ferrari, for example, been in that position with a slower car than Mercedes in the first few laps of the race, I mean, there would have been, certainly, Schumacher, Brawn, Todd era Ferrari, there would have been an instruction would have gone out. Yeah. And you just wonder whether Williams is still not quite tuned into the kind of ruthless winning mentality that would have said, right, never mind whichever you might think you're faster, your job is this, one of you pulls away, the other one backs the Mercedes up. That would have added another element to it, but I think that's going to come at some point, I'm sure.
Given the respect of pace of the two cars, that is the only way that was a winnable race for Williams.
Absolutely,
it was to
sacrifice
one of the drivers.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. And rejoice, rejoice, McLaren scored a point. How about that? Which I predicted.
Yes, marvellous. Well done them.
Okay, fine. Well, it's progress, isn't it? Of a kind, I guess.
I think, had it not been for all the black cars falling out, well, I mean, one of them, two of those were McLarens, but Renault's falling apart, etc. I mean, I didn't see any hint of progress from McLaren at all, personally.
No, none at all. And there hasn't been for several races.
Mark, what's your take on this? We every now and then you hear a rumour that Honda will pull out, how do you see this going forward now?
I don't know about the long-term commitment, because there's been a new president has come in, so I guess he's taken stock. But in terms of the how the partnership is progressing, no, it's not a happy story. And you don't get the impression that Honda... fully appreciates the urgency of a racing program. It's almost treating it as a nice little R&D project, which is obviously frustrating the hell out of the McLaren people. And I think McLaren would like to have more control over it than they have got, because at the moment it's just, well, we don't know when we're going to get decent horsepower or decent reliability. They tell us there's a fix coming, but we don't know when. So it's not obvious where it's heading.
Nigel, you and I...
Well, what Mark says is dead right, but the depressing thing is that when Ross was first at Honda, that was exactly the word he used. You know, this was not... Honda had been in for several years by then with the program they were on at the time. And he just said, I cannot get any urgency into them. You know, it's that was always said of Honda. You know, you talk to Surtees about how things were in the 60s, and he says, you know, it was very much, this is how we do things. So I don't know what it's going to take to turn that around, but I'm still amazed that everybody, all of them, you know, whether it's Eric or the drivers, are still resolutely, you know, coming out with, no, it's going to come round. And there hasn't really been any public sign of, you know, what must be going on under the surface.
Eric was quite outspoken for the first time this weekend when he was saying that, you know, this is damaging McLaren's brand, and you know that you build brand value by being successful and by continuing to be successful, and that affects your income, etc., which it surely does.
Well, particularly bearing in mind the road car manufacturing. Okay, well, that's the British Grand Prix. As I said right at the top of the show, this, in fact, is the first of our new Motorsport Magazine Hall of Fame podcasts. And round the table, we have a panel, Mark Hughes, Nigel Roebuck, Simon Aaron, and the man himself, Damien Smith, who's now going to explain it all.
Okay, so we founded the Motorsport Magazine Hall of Fame in 2010, the idea being a way to celebrate the great names of motor racing, past and present. It was, also a way for us to, have an evening where we celebrated motorsport as well, and everything we stand for now 91 years. So that was the sort of intention behind the Hall of Fame. We did five Hall of Fames over the next 5 years, and they were lovely occasions, very well received by the motor racing community, and we inducted a lot of drivers, riders, engineers, team owners in that time. The idea really is an American idea, the Hall of Fame. It's very popular in the States. It's not done so much over in Britain, which is why we thought there was a room for it over here. And the idea is, well, the first year we announced eight founding members, the kind of people in our sport who would obviously take their place in any Hall of Fame. And that was Nuvolari, Enzo Ferrari, Fangio, Moss, Clark, Stewart, Senna, and Schumacher. And then from then on, we could then induct four, maybe five personalities each year and just keep rolling. The problem with it was it didn't really include our readers and our listeners and the people who are key to motorsport's ongoing success. And we decided to have a rethink on the format and find a way where our readers and our listeners to these podcasts could actually get involved. So from now on, what we're going to do is cut the Hall of Fame each year into categories. So we'll start with Formula One today, but there'll be other podcasts on sports car racing, US racing, motorcycling and rallying. And the idea is that we, between us here, we discuss the kind of people who should be in our Hall of Fame. And we come up with a long list of maybe a dozen names of people from, in this case, Formula One, who should go into the Hall of Fame. But then we hand over to the listeners to these podcasts, to our readers, and you then vote for who goes into the Hall of Fame in 2016. We'll still be holding the glitzy evening somewhere. We haven't quite worked out where or when. There's also a change for that in that we'll be actually selling tickets for that for the first time, whereas in the past it's been in invite only. And, very exclusive, maybe too exclusive. It's a time we became a bit more inclusive. So the evening will still happen at some point next year, but this will give us a way of talking about some great names on the website over the next few months, and in the magazine as well. There'll be a vote that'll be available online this week to kick the ball rolling with Formula One, and as I say, to follow, we'll be doing sports cars and we'll do motorcycling as well. So that's the idea. So what we've done is we've all had a think about who we would have in the Hall of Fame. Previously, the way it essentially worked was Nigel and I would chat, usually over a glass or something, about who should go in next, and it was great fun to do, and always good fun trying to track obviously the those who are still alive down to try and get them to arrive in the evening, and then for those who are no longer with us, then work out a family member who could join us. So this basically opens that discussion up to the public to actually hear how we come up with who's next. We've also asked some of the previous the current members of the Hall of Fame who they would have next. So we've got a few of those have come in as well. So I'll kick things off. And say that Simon contacted Ross Brawn, who was inducted in 2014, and he said Patrick Head, who is of course in the news at the moment anyway because he's just been made a knight.
Yes,
quite rightly. And Ross said, not only for winning many races and championships, but his contribution in developing the talents and establishing the standards of very many engineers and technicians in motorsport, myself included. Nigel, you've known Patrick for... what, 40-odd years? I mean, we wanted to induct him, didn't we, the year that we actually inducted Frank and have the two of them together.
That's
and
right.
Patrick was on holiday, so he couldn't actually make it, unfortunately. Right, yeah. So we thought, well, we'll save Patrick for another day and come back to him. So it's about time, isn't it, for Patrick?
Absolutely. I mean, it was time, you know, when we wanted to do it originally. He should have been one of the very early, you know, inductees. I don't think anybody could argue against that. I mean, Patrick's influence, apart from his own success, you know, the cars he designed, I mean, his influence has been very profound. I mean, you know, a number of other people who've gone on to be great, great designers who sort of essentially trained, you know, under Patrick. So, yeah, for sure.
And Jody Scheckter actually also mentioned Patrick, along with Jason Plato.
He came back with Jason Plato. I know we don't have a category for touring cars, but it's a point for discussion maybe at some point.
Yes.
I mean,
surprised by that, though.
Yeah, but I mean, guys like Matt Neal's been doing 25 consecutive seasons. Alan would know. I mean, is it 25 consecutive seasons? I'm not saying that makes you a Hall of Fame contender, but there are some interesting points that we could perhaps look at some stage.
Maybe.
Yeah.
Yes.
That means no, doesn't it?
Well, if you're saying longevity comes into it, then of course that opens up the field quite a lot.
Yes, it would, wouldn't it? Yeah.
We also asked Mario Andretti, who unsurprisingly really put Ascari down as the guy that he would have it. I mean, Ascari had a huge influence on Andretti's life, didn't he?
Yeah, he did. Absolutely, he did. I mean, he was when Mario was first taken to Monza in 1954. And that was the first time he ever saw a Formula One race. I mean, that was, you know, he'd already fallen in love with racing, but Ascari was already, you know, his man. Any Italian kid, you know, he was his man. And I think, you know, if you bear in mind that Jenks, no less, always said without any question he was the greatest driver of the 50s, and Jenks had no doubts at all he was better than Fangio. We said, no, Ascari could beat Fangio any time he liked in equal cars.
And the last Italian champion, amazing.
The last Italian champion?
Yeah. For a country that's at the heart of everything that motor is.
Well, you know, I mean, arguably, and he was the last great Italian driver, if you use the word great in its proper context. So, he should definitely be in, for sure.
Okay. This long list of 12 is going to be quite hard to keep to 12, I suspect. So, Mark, could I ask you, who would you put in the Hall of Fame?
The one name that comes to mind immediately for me is Mauro Forghieri, Ferrari designer, 60s, 70s, 80s. He had the fantastic era of success in the 70s, but that was when the Fiat money started coming in. Before that, he was virtually creating these cars single-handed. He was responsible. He did everything. He did the chassis, the engine, the gearbox. Ran a team of, I think he had about five helpers, and every year he would come up with a new car. And he inherited a set of engines that were rooted in the 50s, and was constantly on at Enzo that we needed a new generation of engine. And the old man always was saying, well, they didn't have the money to do it. And when the Fiat money finally came in the late 60s, he gave him his head and he came up with that flat 12, which won those titles, was used throughout the 70s. And his first turbo engine was, you know, you bear in mind that Renault had spent millions proving this new technology and God knows how many people. He with a very small group that engine, although the car wasn't a great one initially, that engine was instantly more powerful, more reliable than Renault's. It sort of underlined his mastery of the engine side of it. But I think Nigel would agree he'd done some very good cars as well. I mean, not least the Ferrari 312 T series and the 312B, but during the Chris Amon era, Amon always used to reckon that.
Chris always said the chassis was better than anything else, without a doubt. And the other thing about Maro is, you know, you've got to think all those years, as well as that, he was also doing the sports cars.
Yeah, yeah.
So he really was an extraordinary, you know, one-man band, really.
He tells his anecdote that when he was pushing the old man for investment for the new engine, and the old man had said no, he said, well, I said, well, for 1968, could we at least just concentrate on F1 rather than F1, sports cars, Formula 2, Can-Am, hill climbs? He said, if we can just do that, we would win probably 3 Grand Prix. And he said, all right, we'll do that. And he said, we only won 1 Grand Prix. And he said, so I put my resignation in at the end of the year. And he said, you're not resigning from anything. You're going off to Modena to do this new engine that you want to do. So.
I mean, his career yo-yoed, didn't it? Almost, you know, through different eras. He was in favour and out of favour.
Yeah, it was the political hotbed, wasn't it?
It's true, but when you speak to anybody who worked with him, I mean, if you talk to Nicky about him now, I mean, they all say he was absolutely in his way. He was barking mad, but a genius.
Yeah, absolute genius.
Yeah, and to link 3 decades of Ferrari from the early Surtees era all the way through to the Turbo era, for one man to have that amount of influence.
Yeah, extraordinary.
Yeah. Rob, let's bring you back
good
in.
Good choice. Good stories. I like. Could listen to that a bit longer. Me? Oh, well, I'm unhesitatingly Gordon Murray.
Ah, you're in good company, because Adrian Newey, I didn't see him over the weekend. He was a bit busy for some reason. but he did email me this morning to suggest Mick Doohan for motorcycles. So yeah. We'll come back to that a later date. And then Gordon Murray, it was his suggestion as well. So, Rob, you're in good company. Why Gordon?
Well, for me, all you have to do is just close your eyes and think of those beautiful Brabhams, those beautiful McLarens. But they weren't only beautiful, they were quick. They won races, they won championships. And on top of all that, the McLaren F1 road car, which for me, if I could have any road car on the planet from any era, that would definitely, definitely be it. I don't think anyone will ever build a more exciting, better looking road car. I just think, anyway. And also, you know, what he's done since, venturing into new technologies, new ways of building cars, you know, putting racing behind him and applying that amazing brain. And, of course, he's a genius who is not barking. You know, that's another nice thing about Gordon. And he is interested in all sorts of other things in life. And I like people like that.
He kind of sums up that free-thinking, freewheeling spirit, which, you know, motor racing used to be about.
Sure.
Mm, 70s, yeah.
Yeah, and they were just, I mean, they were, you know, he designed some great Grand Prix cars, didn't he?
Yeah.
Is that enough?
That's good, yeah, yeah. Yeah, I mean, Simon.
Well, unfortunately, my thunder has just been stolen by Widow's R, because Gordon was kind of pretty admirous as well. I mean, for all the reasons that Rob's just said, and I think also the first Grand Prix I attended in person was Silverstone 77, and although James Hunt won most of the afternoon, Watty was ahead in the Brabham Alpha, which looked nicer than everything else and sounded even better. Mm. So, I mean, for those two, I mean, so I've always just got a soft spot for that. But, I mean, another name that I will pitch in, and I suspect I might get winced up from my Lord Right Honourable Roebuck across the table, is Mr. Mansell.
No, you wouldn't.
Yeah, okay, no, just checking. I just think Nigel Mansell, I mean, it sounds like a populist thing to say, but I wouldn't wrap my chips in the Daily Mail. I think he's often quite underrated despite everything he achieved. I mean, people just say, oh, he only started winning when he got into Williams, but I mean, I was lucky enough to see him racing way back in Formula Ford and stuff, and it was very clear back then he was a force of nature. He did Formula 3 on 4p halfpenny and was quick, but always ran out of money about 3 races, and he won a couple of races in the uncompetitive March Triumph Dolomite in the wet, admittedly, but that's kind of a leveller. He got into the Royal Honda in F2s quick in that, but then he was kind of fast-tracked into Formula 1, and he hadn't done a huge amount when he got into F1 because he had such a fractured programme apart from Formula Ford. Most of the things he'd done all had been uncompetitive cars. And, you know, of course it took him time to get up to speed. But this I mean, he put the wind about in Senna, which tells you everything you need to know about the bloke. And I know he had a car advantage in 92, but he didn't always have a car. He didn't have a car advantage again, you know, when he was against Nelson Piquet at Williams in 86, 87. And he outperformed Piquet more often than not. You know, I think his personality was divisive, but you could say the same about Senna, you could say the same about Schumacher. As a racing driver, pure and simple. I think he was marvellous, and you know, for that reason alone, I think he should be in there.
Yeah. Good. Nigel, you knew him all the way through. I mean, from the first Grand Prix when Austria in 1980, when he was sloshing around in the fuel. There was drama, and there was, you know, he was up against it from the start, wasn't he? Bless him. But you saw, I've been always intrigued to talk about Mansell to you, because you saw him develop as a driver but also as a character, and you saw the different facets of him. And he was a very different guy at Lotus to how he ended up at Williams, wasn't he?
He was, but I mean to me, you know, for instance, he was, I thought, for in terms of being easy to deal with, I thought Mansell was at his absolute best when he was at Ferrari. And I expected the very opposite. When he went to Ferrari, I thought, oh, jeez, you know, what sort of chaos is this going to lead to? Thinking of, you know, Italian politics and and everything else. And I just thought, I just don't really see this working. I thought it'd be quick, but I could see all kinds of, you know, of problems. And in point of fact, he was a doddle to deal with in that period. And he was at his least easy to deal with when he went subsequently then back to Williams. And particularly by 92, it was not easy.
But the bloke behind the wheel.
Behind the wheel was. I mean, he took great exception to the fact that I think some of us, Alan Henry and Maurice Hamilton, people and I, did not rate him with Senna and Prost. Not far behind, but we I think we all thought those two were on a separate plateau. But he was really angry about that. And L'Equipe one day, he was being interviewed by L'Equipe, and he described us as, quote, corrupt. Now, we never quite figured how we were corrupt in not rating him with Prost and Senna, but that was, you know, that was his word for it.
He probably meant something else.
He may have done. But I think the problem was, he was, you know, in 92, you know, I still think maybe Mercedes the last year and a half is starting to make me change my ideas a little. I still think FW14B was the most superior Grand Prix car to its opposition that I've ever seen. And I think, I mean, all you have to remember about that year is Patrese was second in the championship ahead of Senna.
Yeah.
But it was almost as if Mansell finally had a car that was quantifiably better than anything else. But he was concerned that the world would say that it was the car that was winning and not him. So, what drove Patrick round the bend that year, you know, any number of times, Nigel would invent a problem with the car that he'd had to, you know, surmount. And it really wasn't necessary. It was the quickest car, and I don't think anybody could have driven it quicker than he could.
Yeah.
And you know, that's what happens sometimes. You know, I mean, look all those years with Michael.
Yeah.
Ferrari. Look with Lewis now. You know, it sometimes happens. You do get far and away the best car, and you just can't help winning.
Yeah.
But don't be embarrassed about it. You know, make the best of it, because you know. A lot of the speak to Alonso.
I was going to say yes.
But I think the in '87 at Silverstone, I remember that so vividly because I was 12 at the time, so I was an impressionable kid who and I didn't have the experience of Mansell the bloke. He was just the driver who was just always exciting. And that chase of Piquet, I think we've talked about this before, Mark. Where quite a few of us were there at the circuit around spectating, and we were actually probably all within a few hundred yards of each other, didn't know each other at the time. And I was a Mansell fan, but you were cheering for Piquet, weren't you? Is that right?
Well, no, I wasn't. I was neutral, but my brother was cheering for Piquet. All right.
And you were at club?
Yeah.
And I was at Stowe.
Yeah. I can tell you the anecdote, but it involves swearing, so...
Alan can beep it out.
So, Warren was down near the front of the crowd, and I'd gone for a cup of coffee or something, so I was several rows back, but I could see where he was. And, Mansell was doing that great comeback drive after he'd
stopped for the the fresh tyres because a wheel weight had come off, and that ended up accidentally being the right strategy. And so he was coming back at him at a great rate of knots. And it was just a question of was he going to have enough laps left? And so I could see Warren, you know, getting a bit stressed, thinking, no. And we actually, so from where we were standing at club, we actually could see across the move. And he looked up back at me and just said, "Bastard!"
You do like a bit of crowd involvement, don't you? I do, love it.
And you could see the reaction of all the Mansell fans around, just looking very puzzled as to why this.
But again, go back to that period, you see, and he was dead easy to deal with. Yeah. He was.
He's a real.
And I remember that too, because when you're talking about that moment, I was in the box with Murray and James and Greg Norman was in there as well, and I can't remember why now.
He was Mansell's friend, wasn't he?
Yeah. He was certainly Mansell's friend, yes, of course, yes, he was, and of course he went bananas. But I remember James looking at me and saying, "I think Mansell's had a rush of blood or something." And it was one of the great passes, wasn't it?
It was, yeah. I saw it.
He would do, that's what he could, I mean, it's like Peraltada with Berger.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, "What the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass!" So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
You know, everybody remembers that. They don't remember that he was behind Berger because he'd had a spin in the first place.
Yeah.
But even so, you know, the parking, the passing manoeuvre was just
fabulous.
Christ, did you really see it?
There was the instance where he'd done a 360 degree spin, I think, Imola. Berger had put him on the grass. Mm-hmm. He'd done a 360 degree spin, and his next flying lap was the fastest lap of the race up to that point.
Yeah.
He wasn't bothered.
No, it's true.
It's no coincidence, Rob, is it, that we're talking more about Mansell than anyone else?
It's inevitable, I'm afraid. It was like that all the way through his career.
It's great.
I wondered, guys, do we see any parallels between Mansell and Hamilton?
Absolutely, I saw it.
Because I did a lot.
Very clearly this weekend, because there's a reciprocal relationship going on there between the driver and the crowd, and they're both very much aware of it, and they very much play to it.
Yeah.
And it's a big part of the kick that they get from it. Yeah. And other drivers sort of seal themselves in this little bubble. But certainly Hamilton and Mansell, the two guys I've seen, actually use a crowd to work a crowd and incorporate it into the performance almost.
Mansell in the past and Hamilton now struggle with themselves.
Yeah, absolutely. Quite often. No, they are. They're both very complex personalities. Yeah. But there's dynamite within them, and when they get access to that, it's thrilling, and that's what a lot of the crowd I think identify with.
Absolutely, real racers. Yeah, interesting. Okay, it's a bit like being down the pub with your mates and having a good old chat about motor racing. So I hope all of you listening are going to join in and vote, because the people are going to decide, aren't they, man?
That's the idea. Yeah. I mean, we've got a few. I've got a slightly left field one from Jackie Stewart, who hasn't gone for someone I'd say he was obvious, very worthy, but he chose Mike Costin of Cosworth fame, obviously the cause of Cosworth.
Yeah.
And I think the reason why he went for Mike is obviously because of the input he had on the most successful Grand Prix engine ever. But also I think he gets overlooked compared to Keith Duckworth's place in history. Typical Jackie to go for someone kind of behind the scenes, I guess, as well, someone who wasn't so much in the public eye. What do you think? Mike Costin a good one for our list?
Yep.
Would it be wise to have Costin and Duckworth as a double act, the same way as the Hills came in as a double act, maybe?
It's quite hard to separate them in that way, isn't it, really, given
I think it'd be unfair to induct Mike and not Keith,
yeah.
and vice versa.
It'd be like separating Cos and Worth,
that,
wouldn't it?
That makes complete sense.
Well, we did put Graham and Damon Hill in together a couple of years ago, so I think if we would...
As a double act.
And we would have put Frank and Patrick put together
if we could have done,
had Patrick been available, so yeah.
Absolutely, okay. So I think those two are...
If you're watching the video, you probably be able to see our web editor writing these names up on our board here.
Yes, Ed's playing teacher.
Has he spelled any of them? Has he spelled them all correctly?
So when he turns his back, we when he turns his back, we throw things at him.
Yeah, you're okay.
Okay, just to explain what he's doing there, that's all.
On my list, were a couple, again, divisive characters in a way. Mike Hawthorne. Now, I've been harangued by a few people, some of our readers, for the fact that Hawthorne isn't already in the Hall of Fame. It's something I'd like to defend against. Now, Nigel, what's your take on Hawthorne? There's a real sort of well of feeling about Hawthorne among a certain generation, I guess, in this country.
Well, I mean, I did see him race, but I mean, when I was little, and I'm not really able to form much in the way of sophisticated judgment. But from my memories of him, and I went to a lot of races with my dad, you know, whether he and Sterling were both there. And what sort of registers from those days is he was one of those drivers who was unbelievable today, and tomorrow you wouldn't know he's in the race. So very up and down. And I think, you know, we subsequently learned after he'd been killed about, you know, just the extent of the health problems he'd had, and particularly his kidney problems. So I think maybe his health, just literally, was he feeling great today or was he not, may have had, you know, quite a lot to do with that. But he certainly was, I mean, on his day, he was fantastically quick and aggressive, and he was a hell of a racer.
I think he was of his time as well. He was sort of emblematic of that Britain coming to the fore in motor racing for the first time in international motor racing.
Yes, he was.
Early post-war.
He was.
And it was a very sort of romantic time, very dangerous time, and he cast a big shadow, didn't he, because of that?
He did.
I think, you know, he's a glamorous figure, and it was fantastic, I guess, to see this young Brit doing stuff that we'd not previously been associated with.
Racing
and he was with them, you know, he was with a major team before Sterling was.
Yeah.
And he was the first Brit to win, you know, to win a Grand Prix for, you know, 53 Grand Pro.
And beat Fangio that day as well.
He did.
Yeah.
I mean, it was at Reims, which was not the greatest driver's track, but I just think, you know, he's one of those people. You could say, and there have been how many, God knows, through history, on his day he could beat anyone. Mm. But it was a matter of, you know, but how many days like that did he have?
Damien, what about pre-war drivers? Are we going to... And also, we've talked about Piquet this afternoon, but is he in amongst the...
Yeah, well, on the first point, the pre-war thing, although this is Formula One, I guess really it should be Grand Prix racing, because we should count pre-war drivers as well. I mean, Nuvolari is obviously a pre-war figure, and he was a founding member. Yeah. And Enzo Ferrari started pre-war, obviously. So, so I think absolutely, yeah. The greats of the pre-war era should be counted. We'll probably call it Formula One for all sorts of boring reasons to do with websites that search engines like Formula One rather than Grand Prix racing. But I'm sure the listeners will forgive us for that and accept that. The pre-war greats are in there. As for Piquet, he's absolutely on my list. Piquet is an interesting one, because I think sometimes in that amazing superpower era of the 80s, he's sometimes overlooked, despite the fact his record is incredible. Mm. And again, you know, and I think he's known as a development driver who was great at testing and setup, but he was also bloody quick as well, wasn't he?
Yep. He was, he was.
And what's your, where did Piquet place for you amongst the centres, Prosts and Mansells?
Oh, high. I mean, not as high as Senna and Prost, but you know, but very high. I think, I mean, he became very pragmatic, I think, Nelson. I think, you know, particularly in 87, he had a huge shunt at, in fact, at Tamburello. And Bernie was trying to persuade Sid Watkins to let him race. And Sid says, well, when he remembers he's a racing driver, I'll think about it. So all that season, and he didn't tell anybody about it at the time, but all that season he was essentially, you know, not right. So a lot of that year he was sort of, you know, kind of, you know, hanging in there rather than, you know, looking to win. And you know, and fooled everybody to an extent. I mean, everybody thought, oh, he's a bit off the pace, but, you know, but he's still right, and he did win the championship that year. So I think, you know, by the time he was with Lotus, he just completely lost interest. I remember being absolutely amazed. JYS ran me one day and said, Benetton are thinking of having Piquet. And I said, really? You know, I was amazed, because by then everybody thought he was just washed up and, you know, finished. But I remember Jackie saying, but I've told them to put him on piecework, which seemed very sensible to me. In other words, pay him by the point.
Yeah, once...
And you'll see something. And in fact, that's exactly what happened.
Once he'd had that injury, he did become very money-oriented.
He did.
And because he hadn't been particularly well-paid early in his career, right, when he was winning those the DFV championships.
In fact, I mean, I remember... I mean, something like this is literally inconceivable now. In 80, which year would it be? I can't remember. 85, 86. 85 was his last year with Brabham, wasn't it?
Yes, it was.
Alan, Henry and I have been watching practice at the Osterreich Ring out in the mountains, which you could do in those days. It was something to see. We walked back down to the paddock, and there was a little caravan in the middle of the paddock with its curtains drawn. Blazing hot afternoon. And as we walked past, there was a tap on the window and the curtain was pulled back, and it was Nelson. And he went... So we went around and went and sat in the caravan and had a beer. And he said, what am I going to do? Do I waste the rest of my life with Bernie, or do I... accept Frank's offer? And I swear to you, that day, neither of us, and we were doing news week in, week out for, you know, Autosport and Motoring News, neither of us had heard about this offer from Frank. There had been rumours, but we didn't know it was an offer. And he then said, you know, Jesus, I was driving pro cars all those years ago because I was making more money doing that than Bernie was paying me to do Formula One, and, you know, I can't go on like this. Bernie's, you know... I think Bernie was paying him $1 million at the time, and very resentfully. But what really Nelson was wound up about was how much Prost was getting from Renault. And Frank's offer was three times as much as Bernie's. And we were in there for about an hour just talking it through. But it, he and I have said many a time since, it's inconceivable now, isn't it, to think of a top Grand Prix driver asking a couple of journalists, what do you think I should do? Anything?
Did Lewis not consult you, Nigel, when he's...
Not often. No, okay. Not often. No, no, but...
Nigel wants to make a cut.
But on the other hand, it's... If Nelson was still racing now, or his equivalent, or... I mean, I don't mean Piquet Jr., because I think he's a different animal, but you could imagine even in 2015, Nelson Piquet, as he was, with his character, would still be exactly the same. Yeah. Still be quite likely to say, well, Sanchez only paying me this and I want that, and what do you reckon? So he was very unusual in that respect. I mean, he was extraordinarily informal, I think is the best way to put it. And actually, Gilles was the same. And there's another name we haven't talked about.
Mr. Editor, we need to move things on a bit because we need to get all the names in the hat.
Okay.
So that all right. Well, I'm saying Gilles right now.
I was going to say, Nigel.
I'm sure Mark will back me up.
Okay. Well,
it's surprising he hasn't come up before now.
Would have just assumed he was already in.
Yeah,
obviously.
Yeah. Thirded.
And what about Murray Walker?
It's an interesting choice.
Gosh, what a silence.
No, I mean, it's left field. We're talking about participants.
Well, personally, I think Nigel and I have talked about this before, and I think before we put Murray in for motorsport, we'd have to put Jenks in first.
We would.
Yeah.
Because I think for our magazine particularly, to put someone who, well, Jenks was a racer in many ways, but...
Yeah, absolutely.
I think, personally, I would put Jenks on the list before Murray for that reason.
Maybe for the Mille Miglia alone, let alone all the...
Well, and also, you know, we were talking earlier on about Patrick and the influence Patrick had on sundry young blokes around him and what they, you know, how they then spent their lives. I mean, Jenks had that effect on anybody of my generation who was sort of aspiring to be a, you know, racing journalist. I mean, he was the, you know, the reason we started it in a way.
So do they all have to be competitors? I mean, we could mention Sid Watkins. I mean, or do they have to be participants as opposed to?
No, I think Sid Watkins' place in motor racing is so intrinsic and so important. I think there are a limited number of people, I think, that we would consider who didn't actually compete or weren't involved in that way. But I think
he should be
Sid,
one of them.
Sid's one of them, isn't he?
Yeah, without a doubt.
Yeah. And if we're talking about the pre-war drivers, we have to include Rosamund Caracciola.
And Lang, I think.
Am I allowed to go sort of pre-war and go to Georges Boyau?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
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 Yeah. Pre the other war.
Yeah, pre the other war, exactly, yeah. Because he should be in there. Ed's now Googling Georges Boyau, is it?
But I think also, we were talking, when just mentioning Gilles earlier on, there are three drivers I always think of who never won a championship between them or didn't actually, you know, in sort of terms of big numbers, which we're all obsessed with these days, win massive number of races.
Yeah.
But to me, Rindt and Peterson and Villeneuve were back on this force of nature thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, in terms of the impact they had on their sport.
Mm-hmm.
I think, you know, each of them, it was massive.
Absolutely, yeah. And I mean, this is the thing that we're getting into now is that the people to go into any Hall of Fame. There's so many from Formula One from history, and you know, someone like Peterson to a younger generation, it's hard to actually express what he meant to people growing up in the 70s. But he was hugely influential, wasn't he?
Yeah. Oh, he was, and Jochen was.
It was just thrilling to watch, viscerally. Yeah,
well, that's
thrilling.
The point. That's the point.
You know, could put them in the Hamilton Mansell sort of.
If you went and stood at the old woodcut, to watch either Ronnie or Jochen through there,
damn right.
Boy, you know.
What about Fittipaldi? Given what he achieved so young, and he could have won so many more Grand Prix if he hadn't gone off with his brother.
Yeah, he could.
At the end of
and the other thing about Emerson is, you know, look what he did in his second life.
Yeah.
Yeah.
In America.
Yeah.
Good choice.
I asked, well, Simon emailed John Surtees, and John, being John, phoned straight back. Simon wasn't at his desk, so I took the call and explained what we wanted. And John took a pause to consider, as he tends to do, and he came up with a couple of interesting names because I think he's always been a forward-thinking kind of bloke, and he suggested Jenson Button and Sebastian Vettel, which I was quite surprised at. I didn't expect him to say that. He's very close to the Button family, I think, through the fact that John built the engines that Henry used to race in karting, and he also said that back in 2000, when Frank was trying to work out who to put in the Williams. John actually suggested to Frank that Jenson would be a good bet, which is quite an interesting one. And Sebastian, I think he said that Sebastian was a great ambassador for the sport, and he's a big Vettel fan. Quite surprising choices. So I said to him, isn't there someone from your racing era that you'd put forward, and he immediately said Gurney as someone we haven't yet got to. And again, the Gurney's another one who surely should have a place in any club such as this.
Just going on to following on from John Surtees' point, I think in future years we'll look back on the current era. I mean, Fettel he's mentioned and Jensen as well, but I think in future years when people look back at, you know, the greats of motor racing, there'll be quite a few of the current or recent drivers who are discussed. Fettel, Alonso, Hamilton.
This is a terrific era.
Yeah, absolutely. They're right up there. Amongst the all-time greats.
This is as good to me as without being disrespectful to Michael, I think Michael's era was
thin.
On an overall level, it was very low.
Michael had Mika Häkkinen was the one. Damon when they had the cast from time to time, but generally it was Mika, and that was it.
Good. Well, we're getting a nice.
We are, and what I should say is, at some point we're going to have to limit this list to 12, and I don't think anyone who's not on that list of 12, it shouldn't be seen as being disrespectful to them, because the plan is for the Hall of Fame to have many years of life, and that we get round to eventually inducting all these people over the years. It's just a question of focusing on who we think would be good for 2016.
Got to start somewhere.
We have to start somewhere, and I think I counted up, there's 29 people that are already in. If you want to check out all the members of the Hall of Fame so far, they're all on the website, and they're all from different walks of life, and they're certainly not all Formula One. We've started with Formula One because it is the most popular category of motor racing and the most prominent, and it's the obvious place to start. The interesting thing about the modern generation is Jackie Stewart, being Jackie, has taken the Hall of Fame very seriously from the start, and he said to me that he didn't feel we should induct anyone who's still racing. He didn't feel it was something that we should do because their careers aren't over. We can't assess their careers in true context.
I think there's something to be said for that, don't you?
There's some truth in that. We have inducted a few.
Adrian Newey and Ross and people who have still been active.
Yes.
I just wonder how you draw the line between an active engineer and an active race driver.
It's quite tricky. I mean, we inducted Ron Dennis in the first year, in 2010, and I still feel quite rightly in terms of the impact that he had on motor racing in his job for, you know, through the 80s and 90s and into the last decade. He wasn't exactly gracious in his acceptance of the award, I would say, it's funny that, isn't it? Yeah,
he doesn't do gracious.
Not really, no. But you know, there's quite a few members of the Hall of Fame who are still very much active in the sport. So, I think
what Jay Wise is saying. I mean, I think that I can see that makes to me absolute sense as regards drivers.
Hmm. Well, maybe
engineers are a different matter because their careers are so much longer and they're still producing when they've been doing it 25, 30 years.
Well, maybe for the Hamilton, Alonso, Vettel, Button generation, we set them aside for now and come back to them in a few years
Actually, just one thing while we're talking about it, somebody at McLaren's was saying to me, they recently asked the real long-standing guys at McLaren, they were going reviewing all the drivers they'd had, including Senna, Prost, who was the absolute quickest, and they all said Häkkinen.
Really?
Mm.
Wow.
Looks like he's going on the board.
That's
then.
Interesting, though,
he's
isn't
on
it?
The board
that's,
as well.
That's including Ayrton.
Yeah.
Which is quite.
Okay.
It kind of backs up that thought we've always all had about Michael's big rival.
So,
don't forget, we've also got the readers and the listeners making their contributions.
Well, absolutely. I mean, a lot of these names have come up over the years because we've had an area of the website where they could put forward their ideas, and I think all these names were on there at different times. So I'm sure no one will disagree with the names that we've come up with. It's a question of actually getting it down to a number we can actually put forward for next year. I thought a dozen was a good number to start with, and it'll be fascinating to see who you choose.
Right, let's decide.
Okay. We've got 18 names on the board.
So we're going to pick 12. We could be here a long time, but we can't be. So let's get into it. And who's an absolute must, Damien?
Right, I think Mansell's an absolute must for me.
Okay. Simon?
I would go with Gordon Murray.
Nigel?
Okay, I will go with Gurney.
Gilles Villeneuve
for Mark Hughes. It's like a game show, I love it. I'm going to go for Häkkinen. Let's keep going.
Okay, so that's five. Let's keep going.
Seven to go.
Well, I think it's good to have some engineers in there. And we've already got Gordon Murray, so we'll have another one. I think we should go for Patrick Head.
Alberto Ascari.
Jochen Rindt.
Nice dramatic pause, Nigel.
Sorry.
That's okay.
I do feel like Carol Gordon.
you look a bit like Carol Gordon.
That's probably not on mic, so I better just say. Ed's saying he feels like Carol Vorderman.
As I nominated them, I should say Mara Fokeri.
Okay. I'm going to go... mine is Costin and Duckworth, because that was an extraordinary event when that engine appeared at Zandvoort.
Yep. So that's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. So we're down to 8. We've got eight on the list now.
Oh,
so I'm going to just work out who else...
Your turn again.
So one of the problems, I was about to say Jenks, but the trouble is if you have Jenks, then really for this magazine, you'd have to have Boddy as well, wouldn't you? Because they were inseparable.
Isn't Jenks really in our kind of Hall of Fame in the sense that he's just such an integral part of the motorsport magazine anyway?
Yeah, he's really. Okay, I think I'll go for Fittipaldi.
Okay. Monsieur Aaron.
Sid Watkins.
So we've got two more, because we've got 10,
okay,
I think.
Nigel.
Actually, there's a name that we mentioned who's not on the list, Ed, which is Caracciola.
Good call.
And I would be tempted to say him.
The last one is yours, Mark Hughes.
And Rosemeyer.
Rosemeyer.
Double C.
Yep. Good, fantastic. Okay, well, I guess the excitement really is for our listeners and readers now, isn't it, David?
Yeah, it's over to them. So there'll be an area of the site, will be very obvious where you go on to vote for. I'll run through the names just very quickly, but they'll be on the site. So two pre-war names in Caracciola and Rosemeyer. We have from the 1960s, Dan Gurney and obviously Costin and Duckworth from that era, and Forghieri. We have from the 70s, we have Gordon Murray, Gilles Villeneuve, Patrick Head, Emerson Fittipaldi, and Sid Watkins was very much starting in the 70s, wasn't he? And then into the... 80s Mansell and 90s Häkkinen. Yeah, that's the list.
It's a good list. It's a nice broad list.
Yeah.
And just to remind everybody, we're not choosing current drivers on the advice of Sir Jackie Stewart, just in case people are thinking, where is Vettel or Button or whatever. Okay.
And, you know, it's really hard because the people we've left out this year for now include Peterson, Piquet, Hawthorne, all you know. Boileau was a good shout from Simon earlier on. I mean, these are all people absolutely worthy, and it's not like they're being overlooked, because they'll probably be on the list next time.
Well, the fun thing is that we can all think about it over the next few weeks, and so can everybody listening, and all the people who read Motorsport magazine.
Yeah.
And it would be fun to give it some thought and come up with some fresh ideas.
The fun thing is going to be trying to track down Georges Boyer's relatives when the time comes.
Your job.
Yeah, I believe it. I thought it might be.
Quite tricky.
And it is spelt correctly up there, by the way, everybody, just in case you... Okay.
The vote is going to be open for the rest of the year, basically, because we want as many people as possible to vote, and we want to publicise this as much as we can to get as many people involved. As I say, we'll be looking at other categories of motorsport coming up, so we'll be doing sports cars next, I think towards the end of August is the plan. And we hope to get some special guests in to join us, along with our panellists, current Halls of Fame members who are available and can make it to join us in the motorsport office. So watch this space on.
Absolutely. Well, I hope you've enjoyed it, everybody. If you're going down to the pub this evening, you can get your mates together and have a good old chinwag about it. I think it would be fun, wouldn't it? Yeah.
And we can expect the flurry of people from saying, why isn't Kimi Raikkonen top of the list?
Absolutely.
Ah, yes.
Most popular Formula One driver.
Yes, the most popular Formula One driver in the world.
I know.
Interesting. Surprised by that, Mark Hughes?
Not really. No, he's different.
Maverick.
Maverick.
No, he's the anti-hero.
Absolutely. Doesn't surprise me at all.
The girls love him in China and Malaysia as well, don't they, in Japan? They all love Kimi, don't they?
Yeah.
But people like the churlish responses and, don't give a damn. And
You go to India and the few motorcyclists that have got helmets on, they're all Kimi Raikkonen replica helmets.
Oh, perhaps I'll try a bit of churlishness.
Actually, well, it works very well. Works very well.
Yes. Okay. Well, thank you very much, Damien, for putting all this together for us. And
I'd like to thank Nigel and Mark for coming in, especially for this one. Especially Mark, given that he's had hardly any sleep because he was busy writing the Grand Prix report overnight. So, thanks for joining us.
If you're watching the video, this is what Mark Hughes looks like after a Grand Prix with no sleep. Not bad, actually. Never mind the facts, eh, Mark? Okay. Well, thanks, everybody, for listening. And a big thank you, too, of course, for reading our motorsport magazine. So if you're in any doubt about this, there'll be plenty more about the Hall of Fame, both in the magazine and on the website. And we should say thank you very much to Ed Foster, who's our website editor, who's our whiteboard man today. And, of course, to Alan, who's been recording all this out of your picture. So, good. Thank you very much, everybody. And we look forward to seeing you next time. And I think it's less than a month away, and we'll be talking to Tony Southgate. That'll be a real good one. Yeah. So join us then. Thanks. Bye-bye, everyone.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.